Imagine if today was the day your idea changed someone's life. Imagine if you could help someone pay for college, help your community build a new playground, or help a child make it to that dream competition. With GoFundMe, it's all possible. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform trusted by over 190 million people. Every week, ordinary people meet their goals and do extraordinary things. Your ideas matter. GoFundMe isn't just for emergencies. Want to raise money for your kid's soccer team or raise funds for a small business, a creative project, or event? GoFundMe helps you turn ideas into reality. And help adds up. Fundraisers you start for someone else raise up to 5 times more. So think right now, who could use your help? Change rarely comes from waiting. It comes from someone deciding, today I'll start. Don't wait for someone else to bring change. Today, start your fundraiser in just minutes at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com to start your fundraiser. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish but have everlasting life.
Your key to financial opportunity.
Chapter 11, Part 2, An Ordinary Country Road. June 14th, 1985, The Wichita Eagle. Remetta says he threatened girlfriend with gun. Interior courtroom.
Mr. Brooks, would you state your name and address for the court, please?
Charles R. Murray, also known as Jock Murray, Topeka, or I live at Colby.
Okay, and what is your occupation, sir?
Special Agent, Kansas Bureau of Investigation.
Mr. Murray, at the time you re-interviewed Fred Sager, how many individuals did he describe that he saw? How many males?
Fred said he saw 3 guys.
Did he tell you what individuals had guns?
Yes.
Please tell the jury what he said insofar as telling you what individuals had guns in their hands when he saw them.
One subject was described as slender. Dark, long, dark, black, greasy hair, wearing dark clothes and having a gun. Another subject behind the car with a gun was described as having dark blonde or brown hair, wearing a light green jacket, and shorter than Rick, is the way he described him, as height. Now, he did describe an individual to you with a beard, did he not?
Yes, one subject had a beard.
That's all he said about him, just had a beard. He did not indicate to you that the bearded man had a weapon?
No.
Alright, now Agent Murray, where were you when you started to receive radio traffic of the series of events that were taking place in Gove County and Thomas County?
I was at the Sheriff's Office in Goodland when I received the radio report to proceed to Grainfield, homicide at Stuckey's.
And is that what you did? You left Goodland Sheriff's Office and got on the road, right?
Yes, I did. I never did get to Grainfield.
Alright, did you, before arriving at Grainfield, did you begin to hear traffic of other things that had happened?
Yes, before I left the Sheriff's Office at Goodland, I heard traffic that Ben Albright had been shot.
And then I proceeded west, and then I heard other traffic as I came east toward Colby.
Did you hear any traffic indicating that there had been 2 individuals shot that were lying on the country road?
Yes, I did. Now, what did you, Agent Murray, when you got to the Levant exit as you were heading east?
When I first got to the Levant exit, Ben Albright's car was sitting on the downrent, westbound downrent, north side of I-70. Doors open, no one around. I'd already pulled off from I-70 off of the eastbound exit ramp. So I drove the wrong way up the ramp to Ben's car, just to check. No one around it. About that time, the subject, and I forgot his name now, but came down over the bank and parked his pickup on the road on I-70 and identified himself as an insurance man out of Goodland, Kansas. I asked him if he would stay there with Ben's car until some officer could get back to the scene, and he did so. Mr. Baird, ma'am, would you please state your name and address for the record, please? Judy McKee, McDonald. What county is that in? Rawlins. Rawlins County. Okay, Rawlins County. I'd like to direct your attention, if I could, back to February the 13th of 1985. Do you recall that day, ma'am? Yes, I do. Did you happen to be in Thomas County, Colby, Kansas on that day? Yes, I was. And where were you at, say, around 4 p.m.? I was getting ready to leave my mother's home and go home. Your mother lives here in Colby? Yes, she does. Were you by yourself, ma'am? No, I had two children with me. What are their ages, by the way? At that time, one was 4 and the other one was 2. And you were returning to your home? Yes. Okay, what route did you take, or should I say, on that day, what route did you take to go back to your home? Highway 24 to Brewster, and then from Brewster North. Do you have any idea approximately what time it was that you left your mom's house? Around 4 o'clock that I left her home. Okay, and did you stop anywhere, or were you going to stop anywhere on the way? Yes, I was going to stop in a department store, but one of my children had fallen asleep before we had gotten there, and my other one was, he had some grievances, so we just went home. Okay, now Highway 24, does that go by Levant, Kansas? Yes, it does. And that's the route you're telling us that you were taking on that day? Yes, sir. And as you were traveling that route on February the 13th, 1985, did you have the occasion to become somewhat concerned about another vehicle that was on that road? Yes, sir. Okay, and would you tell us how that came to pass? Well, as I was heading west on Highway 24 and getting close enough to the town of Levant, I had noticed, looking off towards the elevator. I was watching the weather because it looked snowy that day, and I had watched a pickup leave the pavement and proceed on what looked like a wheat field that had been blocked off by the county. And then when we passed them, they were just, you know, right behind me coming up out of the ditch. The ditch was really weedy at the time. Okay, now during the time you saw the truck, when you first observed it, did you pay any attention at all? Were you concerned about it? Not at that particular point, except for the fact that they didn't go the usual flow of traffic to the stop sign. Okay, and I just kept watching it. Okay, and as you watched it, what if anything did you see? It just proceeded on coming towards me, and at that point I realized that we were probably coming pretty close together. So when they started to get closer to me, I proceeded to watch, kind of locked in on the driver to see if he saw me coming. Or was going to slow down, or, you know, just what was going to take place there. Was he looking up at you as well? Well, he looked up, but we never, I don't think, I could say we never made real eye contact because he was pretty busy, you know, inside the cab there. You say pretty busy, what do you mean by that? Well, they were visiting, him and the passenger, and laughing, and, you know, it looked very relaxed, like they were just having a good old time. As if he wasn't paying attention to you? Uh-huh. That's what concerned you? Uh-huh. So you watched him until you went by, is that correct? Yes, uh-huh. How many people did you see in the cab of the truck? On the front seat of that pickup, I saw two individuals. Okay, and did you see anyone else in the cab of the front seat? No, sir. Do you think you would be able to identify the individual that was driving that truck if you ever saw a photograph of him again? No, I don't think so. I'd like to show you what's been marked as State's Exhibit Number 18 and ask you whether or not you can identify that, please. Yes, sir, that was the driver. That was the driver of the truck? Uh-huh. Now I'd like to show you what's been Mr. Baird. Well, Your Honor, I'd move for the admission of State's Exhibit Number 21, the court. Any objection? Mr. Brooks. I have no objections. Mr. Lewis. I have no objections. The court. It will be admitted. Mr. Brooks. We'd also like to record to show that Miss Judy McKee just identified State's Exhibit 18, which has been identified as Mark Walter. Mr. Baird. No objection. The court. So noted. Mr. Baird. Miss McKee, you told me that the driver that you just identified in the photograph as Mark Walter, you didn't know the name, that he was laughing and talking to someone else in the cab of the car or truck? Yes, sir. And what were you able to observe about the conversation? Conversation, smiling, just the general gist of a happy, lucky environment, you know? But before I got to the end of the dryer, I heard what sounded like a shot. Okay, what did you see when you got there at the end of the dryer? Well, I didn't know what was going on, but I saw my dad and Rick Schrader, the employee of the elevator. Did you know Rick Schrader? Yes, I'd grown up with him. Where did you see him? They were sitting in the back of the pickup. They were sitting on the driver's side in the box. My dad was on the outside, and Rick Schrader was sitting next to him. Did you see anybody else in the back of that truck? Yes, there were two other people in the back of the truck. Did you know either of them? No, I sure didn't. Where were they located at in the truck? The one, I seen the gun and everything. He was sitting like on the fender well in the back of the pickup, and the gun was visible. And then I seen someone else sitting back next to the tailgate, but I didn't get a good look at the person sitting clear in the back. Okay, did you see anybody get into the truck? No, I sure didn't. And this person had a gun? Yes. Could you see his face? Yes. Do you see him in the courtroom today? I do. Would you please point him out? It is Daniel Rometta. Based on what you observed that day, your observations, do you feel that your father and Rick were leaving with this individual with the gun because they wanted to? No. My dad was huddled over in the corner of the box with fear. Mr. Brooks, can you explain to the jury why you would have been looking at the driver? Because we were approaching each other, and just being a cautious driver, I wanted to see if he could see, if he was aware that I was there. Okay. And I had finally realized that I was much further ahead of him than, well, whether he saw me or not was my major concern at that point. That I knew I was safe. Okay, but you saw his facial expressions rather well? Yes, sir. And you saw that picture Mr. Baird showed you? Yes, sir. Obviously, he didn't have blood on him. That's not a pretty picture. Uh-huh, correct. Did he have a partial beard? He had a start of a beard, and it was, you know, just a shaded area, is what I could remember. Okay. In the lower jaw, did you notice his hair? Could you tell me how long it was? Ear-length hair. Did you tell what color it was? Dark brown. And you're positive it was a man? Yes, very positive. And you're positive it's this picture that Mr. Baird showed you? Yes, sir. And can you describe his clothing at all? Dark jacket or outerwear, in a white or light beige colored shirt. Okay, and a dark cap. Okay, now you first gave your statement to Mr. Murray, is that right? The KBI agent? Mr. Jack Murray, yes. Jock Murray. Oh, uh-huh. Mr. Jock Murray. Jock Murray? Uh-huh. Okay, and have you looked over that statement since then? Yes, sir. Have you added anything to that statement? No, sir. Have you changed anything? No, sir. In that statement, Mr. Murray, he didn't write it word for word, obviously. But when you read that statement, it's not word for word, is it? Very general, very broad, I'd say. Okay, he wrote here that the driver was laughing. Did you believe you told him that? Yes, I saw a good full set of teeth. Okay, and are you testifying today that you saw the passenger or the other passenger you saw in the cab of the pickup laughing too? I'm not saying that that person was laughing. But there, I could see a smile, you know? In the conversation and mannerisms. Okay, you started to say, I'm not saying she... Was the other passenger a she? I'm not certain. Okay, no further questions, Your Honor. All right, and then I take it you proceeded on to Levant? Yes, I drove up to Levant. The elevator had been more or less secured by that time, so then I proceeded on east on 24 towards Colby. Turned off at the 4 mile corner and went north. Alright, did you arrive at the scene where you found two bodies lying in the road? Yes, I did. Can you tell me, Agent Murray, approximately how long it took you to go from the Goodland Sheriff's Office to get to that crime scene? I arrived at the crime scene at approximately 4:45. I probably left Goodland probably 4:15 or something like that. When you arrived at the crime scene, where the individuals were laying in the road. Alright, and did you determine, sir, that you'd take charge of the crime scene? Well, I took photographs and measurements and so on. Did you examine the crime scene, Agent Murray? For footprints, any sort of physical evidence? Yes, I did. Did you find any? I found a tire track just before the scene, before you got to the bodies, and then it just left the bodies. There were some footprints just north of the bodies, scuff marks. Scuff marks, more or less. Like two or three people maybe had walked around there. But they was just scuff marks. There was nothing that was identifiable. Did you see a footprint left by a waffle stomper type boot? No, I did not. All right, I believe that's all I have. The court. Mr. Baird? Yes, Your Honor, please. Okay, did you, you told us you took measurements. Yes, I did. What measurements did you take, sir? Measurements of where the bodies was lying, from a distance from the road and from one another. Did you prepare that in some kind of report, sir? Yes, you should have a copy of it. I've got a copy. Maybe I did. Can you jog my memory there? It's right here. Okie dokie. Well, that's kind of small. Do you mind? I was going to use your report, but if you don't mind, testimony's been received in the court by Detective Randy Jones that when he observed the crime scene, he saw this right here, this footprint. Okay, now your testimony is that you did not see that? I did not see that. I stated before, I did not see that. Was there any snow at all that night? It snowed real hard there for about 5 to 10 minutes while I was at the crime scene. Can you tell the jury whether or not it snowed, if you can recall the time, from the time that you knew Randy Jones was at the crime scene with the victims, the bodies, Mr. Moore and Mr. Schrader, and in the time you arrived to process that scene? I don't believe it snowed before I got there, no. It started snowing shortly after I got there, a short time after. Did it snow pretty heavily? Well, the wind was blowing real hard and fairly heavily there for about 5 to 10 minutes. Is it out of the realm of possibility, sir, that with that snow and wind, a small footprint or a footprint as indicated there in the picture could have been covered up? Yes, sir. And you didn't get a chance to see it? Could have been, yes. Officer, I ask whether or not you can identify the individual in that photograph. Yes, I can. This is Glenn Moore. Okay, is that the Glenn Moore you found on the road, the 4 mile road? Yes, sir. Okay, I'll show you what's been marked as State's Exhibit Number 7, sir, and ask if you can identify that. Yes, I can. This is Rick Schrader. And was Rick Schrader the other individual you found on the road? Yes, he is. And they were both dead? Yes, sir. Did you find any evidence that would have indicated to you?
Imagine if today was the day your idea changed someone's life. Imagine if you could help someone pay for college, help your community build a new playground, or help a child make it to that dream competition. With GoFundMe, it's all possible. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform trusted by over 190 million people. Every week, ordinary people meet their goals and do extraordinary things. Your ideas matter. GoFundMe isn't just for emergencies. Want to raise money for your kid's soccer team or raise funds for a small business, a creative project, or event? GoFundMe helps you turn ideas into reality. And help adds up. Fundraisers you start for someone else raise up to 5 times more. So think right now, who could use your help? Change rarely comes from waiting. It comes from someone deciding, today I'll start. Don't wait for someone else to bring change. Today, start your fundraiser in just minutes at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com to start your fundraiser. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Do you that there had been any struggle or fight at that location? No, sir. Will you tell this court how it was the bodies were laying in the ditch on the road? Where were they? They were laying on the road. Rick was to the west of Glenn, and they were both to the right of the center of the roadway, laying exactly side by side, with their heads pointing to the north and their feet to the south. Detective, in your observation of Mr. Moore and Mr. Schrader laying in the road, were you capable of observing any gunshot wounds to their person? Where were those wounds? In the head area. Okay, thank you very much, sir. I have no further questions. Mr. Lewis, Officer Jones, was it snowing at the time you found those two bodies on the road? No, sir. What was the weather like? It was overcast and in the north, the sky was darker blue. It appeared that there was the possibility that there was something moving in. But was there any precipitation of any kind falling? No, sir. Not while I was there. Now, the road that you were driving on is a dirt road, right? Yes, sir. The road that you found these two victims on is just an ordinary country road. Yes, sir. I forgot to ask you, and I should cover it with you. At the time that you noticed that these individuals were dead when you first arrived on the scene, did you notice any wounds that would have caused death? Yes, I did. Will you show us and tell us where they were at? Are you capable of doing that? Yes, sir. On Rick Schrader, right behind where his hat was resting, in the back of his head was a wound. There was tissue, I would call it brain tissue, sticking out about a thumb's length out of the back of his head. And on Mr. Moore in his cap, right to the, it would be to the left side of the center there, there was a hole in it. Okay, did it appear to you to be a gunshot wound as well? Yes, sir. Would you explain to the jury, doctor, if you could, with those x-rays, what you were looking for and what you found? Alright, this is an x-ray of the side of Mr. Schrader's skull, and the entrance wound in the skull was in that region. These are fractures of the skull secondary to the bullet wound. The bullet itself was found in the soft tissue of the upper left cheek in this plane. So in the side plane, you can see the bullet is traveling toward the front. This is the forward view as you would look at it, me as I am looking at you. There's the eye socket showing on the right skull. The fractures from the point of the entrance of the bullet is tracked through the brain and through the bones of the upper jaw. Bullet wound or the bullet being found out here again in the left upper cheek region, indicating a downward travel from the right to the left. Okay, thank you, doctor. Thank you. The body was clothed and identification was made through the driver's license, photograph, and other materials on Mr. Moore. We took our photographs, then again did external examination of the clothing. The deceased Mr. Moore had a blue outer denim work jacket on. We noted a tear in the collar to the right side of the collar, which had a black bullet wipe around the fabric itself. There was no powder residue. This was tracked through his outer denim jacket into the right front shirt pocket. At this point, the bullet wound passed beneath his shirt and into some undergarments, the long johns he had on. There was minimal blood staining of this wound. Also, doctor, based on the testimony we've already received, I positioned Mr. Schrader in this position. Would you demonstrate for the jury, as you did there, the angle and the entry point? Again, the point of the entrance of Mr. Schrader's skull was on his right and indicated a travel downward towards the front of his face. Did you also demonstrate on here, doctor, where the actual bullet was found? The bullet was found here, in the soft tissues of Mr. Schrader's upper lip, upper cheek area. Officer Convoy, other than the two shots that you've described, and I don't know whether you would be able to, sir, but other than the two shots you described, the other one that hit your car and the one that hit the Colby police officer's car, could you tell whether or not any of the other shots were being directed in your manner or being fired by the individuals from the pickup? No, sir, I couldn't. In a very short time there were shots going all over the place. Okay, how long do you think, for lack of a better term, this shootout lasted? Seconds, a matter of seconds. And then it was over? Yes, sir. All right, I interrupted you. Maybe there's a sequence of events you would like to follow. You've told me that you're returning fire underneath the truck. What's the next thing you recall happening in the sequence of events? Well, a passenger had gotten out on the passenger side of the pickup, ran west between some trees and a large metal storage building. Did you lose sight of that individual? Yes, sir, I did. Did you have a chance to view him for a very long time? Or that person for very long? No, sir, just a few seconds. Okay, what if anything transpired after you saw him, after you lost sight of him anyway? Well, after the shooting had stopped, I saw Officer Brown and Officer Dybel run to the north side of the metal building. A moment or two later, Officer Brown came back to the east side of the metal building and he was yelling at someone behind the truck, which I could not see, to come away from the truck. A white female stood up, walked north about 10 steps away from the truck. She then fell down yelling that she was hurt. Okay, and what did you do then? Officer Brown then motioned for Officer Ebert and myself to come forward, which we did. When I reached the passenger side of the pickup, I could see two white males laying face down in the snow. The driver of the truck was dead. The other person was wounded. The other person, was that a male or female? It was a male. All right, sir. And you indicated that there was also a female there that had gotten up and moved? Yes, sir. Did you just observe three people within that immediate area? The one that was dead, the male and the female, when you got into that location? Yes, sir. That's right. Did you have an opportunity to view those people, their faces at that time? Yes, sir, I did. Sir, I hand you what's been marked as State's Exhibit number 18 and ask you whether or not you can identify the person in that photograph. Yes, sir. This is the driver of the pickup. Okay, and was that the driver later identified to you as Mark Walter? Yes, sir, he was. Okay, as you approached the pickup truck and you saw the driver was dead, and the other male that you identified as Rametta laying in the snow, and the female that you've identified as Lisa Dunn there, what if anything happened next as you perceived it, officer? Well, the female was yelling and screaming the whole time we were walking up there and securing the scene. What was the female yelling and screaming about, sir? She was screaming constantly. Things that I remember her saying is, "You asshole shot the wrong guy." She also said, "I love you" several times, talking to someone behind the pickup, and I couldn't see who she was talking to. She also said, "It's all there, it's all there. The money's in the purse." Did you see, did you determine later on whom it was she was yelling to that she loved? Well, there was only one person alive behind the pickup. And who was that? Daniel Rametta. When you got back to this location and you put Mr. Hunter in a kneeling position right here where you marked the H on the diagram, can you tell us what the location was of anyone else? Yes, sir. At the time, Lisa Dunn was in a position about like that, and Daniel Rametta was laying roughly in that area there, away from the right side of the front of the Ford pickup. And was Mark Walter, where was he at the last time you saw him? Beside the truck? Yes, sir. Mark Walter was laying prone along the side of the pickup, roughly in that position. And when you came back to that location, did you hear any conversation between either Lisa Dunn, James Hunter, or Daniel Rametta? Yes, sir. Would you tell us what that was, please? Well, she was screaming and yelling, "You shot an innocent man. You shot the wrong man. You motherfucker shot the wrong man." Sheriff, when you arrived at the Bud Roche scene and when you first observed the defendant Hunter, he had already been arrested and placed in, he was in custody when I first observed defendant Hunter. That is correct. All right, sir, you did not, Sheriff, at any time during your time there at the Bud Roche farmyard, see exhibit number 18 in the possession of Mr. Hunter? I'm speaking of the Ruger semi-automatic. No, I did not. So you are just engaging in a local assumption when you say it was close to where he was and therefore maybe he had it. You did never see him have it, is that right? I didn't see him have it. I'm principally interested in the weapon. Yes, I can identify that. And what is it, sir? That is a Ruger automatic recovered at the Bode Rush Farm on the evening of February 13th, 1985. Did you know whose possession that weapon was in prior to recovering it, sir? From where it was located, the only person that would have had been in that area would have been J.C. Hunter. Is that individual in the courtroom here today, sir? Yes, he is. Would you please point him out? He's sitting with a sports coat and a dark blue sports coat, white shirt, tie, mustache. Yes, I came to a conclusion. What was that conclusion? That I cannot identify this bullet as coming from this gun. Okay, and is there a particular reason for that, sir? Well, the bullet, in the area that was not mutilated, was completely smooth, indicating either that there had been action on the bullet that had been removed from the individual characteristics, or more plausibly, it had been a jacketed bullet and had shed the jacket, leaving no individual characteristics from the barrel of the gun. Okay, how long after cuffing and securing the prisoners was it that you heard any statements from Daniel Rometta? Well, the only statements I heard from him were in the ambulance. The ambulance came from Atwood. I do not recall how long it took for them to come and pick him up. You cannot estimate for us? Not the time, no, sir. Okay, did you hear Mr. Rometta tell you who shot Lisa Dunn? He made several statements, and that was one of them. Okay, and who did he tell you shot Lisa Dunn? He told me JC shot Lisa. You didn't know who JC was at the time, did you? No, I did not at the time. Okay, Randy, you testified the other day with the use of a picture painting that you had made. Yes, sir. And you referred to a Waffle Stomper boot print? Yes, I did. Correct. And you identified Mr. Hunter's shoes as possibly being of that style that would have made that type of boot print? Yes, sir. Okay, I hand you what has been marked as State's Exhibit 29, and you were shown these the other day too, were you not? No, this is the first I've seen these. So you did not see these the other day and hold them up for the court? No, I held up the boots. Okay, I believe Officer Ekberg held these up. That's right. Can you look at the tread on that shoe? Yes. Okay, can you tell me, is it the type that would have made this Waffle Stomper boot print that you described? It is not. No further questions, Your Honor. Mr. Baird. Officer Jones, you, in response to questions, you stated that there was one of several statements that Mr. Rometta told you on the way to the hospital. Is that correct? That's correct. And the one statement was that no copper had shot her, that JC had shot her? Yes, sir. You stated that JC had shot her with the .22. And then no copper had shot her? Yes, no copper had shot her. What was the second statement that he made, sir? Well, he made the statement several times, and he also stated that either Mark or JC had killed the two guys on the road. The condition of that vehicle, the inside of it, would you describe it generally when you saw the car? Filthy. Were the conditions in that area where you searched for blood or a bullet hole or any evidence of a shooting good conditions upon which to search for that kind of evidence? No, sir. The conditions were, as I mentioned, there was quite a bit of dirt, residue in the area. There were items of trash laying on the floor in the area. These items were all picked up and removed from the vehicle so that a more thorough search could be made of those particular areas. Okay, there's a possibility then that some of that evidence may have been removed. Evidence of a shooting may have been removed when the trash was picked up. No, sir. No, sir? In other words, you checked all of that trash for residue and so on? I checked all the trash. No further questions, Your Honor? Mr. Lewis, I just have one question. You may not be able to answer it. Can you tell us how many separate items you removed from that Oldsmobile? The items that I collected from the first examination, it was approximately 290. Thank you, sir. Okay, why did you go back to see Mrs. Moore? Miss Moore used a telephone to her office and advised that she had found a t-shirt, which she felt was of evidentiary nature. Okay, can you describe the court where she found that? Yes, sir. It was in the pickup belonging to Glenn Moore, behind the jump seat on the driver's side. Behind the jump seat in the back of the cab area. Okay, and she located that when she was cleaning out the pickup? Yes, sir, that's correct. It bears James Hunter's name in the collar area and in my mark on the tag. Miss Messamore, now what time did you receive a phone call from Fred Sager at Levant?
The first phone call I received from Levant was at 4:15.
And what did he tell you?
He gave me his name and that he was at Levant Elevator in Levant and that there had been a shooting in Levant.
Well, actually, when I first answered the phone, there was an operator on the line. I believe I spoke to Fred Sager and then the phone was handed to Ray Harimza.
Okay, now then, Randy Jones is 102, right?
Yes, that's correct.
What time did he call in and advise you that he could see two individuals on the road in front of me?
The first time he gave me some traffic, when he told me he had two victims, was at 4:28 p.m.
Okay, and how long after that did he advise you he had two homicides?
Again, I did not write the time down. You have to understand it was going very fast and I had a lot of traffic.
Yeah, it was just seconds.
Alright, so 4:09 is when you first found out Ben was wounded.
Yes, sir.
By 4:28, Detective Jones had advised you that he's got two homicides on the road.
Yes, sir.
Okay, can you tell us, Mary, at what time you were advised that you had suspects in custody at the Roche Farmyard?
Again, I don't have the time written down. The first traffic that I had, they had suspects in custody between traffic with an ambulance at 4:55 and traffic with 102, Randy Jones, at 16:58 or 4:58.
At that point in time, this was all over with?
Yes, sir.
People were already arrested.
Yes, sir.
Can you tell me, Mary, when you were advised that a female prisoner was being transported to the Citizens Medical Center here in Colby?
When she was being transported?
Uh-huh. I can give you a little help, Mary, because I've got your written statement. Would you look at 1817?
1817?
Uh-huh. Yes, that would be the time that the ambulance was advised of the injury to the female.
Prior to that, at 6:12 is what time they would be. They advised me that they were 10:08.
They advised me that they were 10:08, which means that they were en route to the hospital.
And as far as any traffic concerning these crimes on February 13th, 1985, by 1817 is 6:17 p.m.?
Yes, sir.
By 6:17, the suspects had all been removed from the Roche Farmyard, and the last one had been taken to the hospital.
Yes, sir, they were moved to the hospital.
Okay, that's all. Thank you very much, Mary.
Mr. Brooks,
I have no questions for Mary.
The court.
Mr. Baird?
Very briefly, Your Honor.
Mary, so the jury fully understands those times we're dealing with. Those are not absolutes, are they?
No, sir.
Normally, a dispatcher tries to record as accurately as possible incoming and outgoing calls or requests of officers, do they not?
Yes, sir.
On that particular night, you were dealing with a multitude of officers, ambulances, different agencies, were you not?
Yes, I believe there was like 20-some people here.
So you tried to do the best you could in keeping terms of time and entries. As a matter of fact, you missed some entries because of the workload, right?
Right.
So what you're trying to do is give us your best estimate as to the best you could handle it at the time.
That's correct.
Thank you, Mary. No further questions.
Mr. Lewis.
Your Honor, if we could please take an afternoon recess. Mr. Brooks and I can confer a little bit.
I have no more questions. I'm sorry.
The court. Are you through with this witness?
Mr. Lewis.
I'm sorry. I have no questions. Thank you, Mary.
Mr. Lewis.
I think we've probably come to a stopping point.
The court.
All right, ladies and gentlemen. I've admonished you several times not to discuss this case. Now we'll take a 15-minute recess. Take them to the jury room, Mr. Bailiff.
Mr. Albright, did you radio for help that day?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and I'm assuming an ambulance came and, did you have any difficulty at all, let's put it that way, in maintaining your radio communications and watching the car and radioing the stuff in? Did you feel that you were in control of the situation, sir?
Yes, sir. The radios are positioned in the car where they're handy. You don't have to duck down to get them. I feel I was in complete control after they left.
Okay, did the ambulance take you to the hospital?
Yes, sir.
Can you tell us whether or not you were operated on for those bullets?
Yes, sir. I was operated on at Colby Hospital a couple of days after the initial shooting to remove a bullet from my arm and one again from just underneath my shoulder blade on the right side.
As a result of those shots, and I'd like to chat with you about that for just a minute, okay? Did you receive any physical permanent impairment as a result of, let's say, being shot in the chest?
Yes, the bullet damaged a nerve in the chest which controls the diaphragm, which the diaphragm is the mechanism of breathing,
That's what makes you breathe in and out. Because of the damage to the nerve, my right diaphragm is paralyzed, which means it just sits there. It doesn't do anything. So I basically have one lung that's effective right now. Also, because of the anesthesia that they had given me, I developed what's termed as reactive airway disease, which presents itself in the form of asthma. So now my good lung has asthma, which I didn't have before, and the other lung is just, it's just hanging there. What does that do to you in terms of breathing? Just simple breathing. It makes me very short of breath when I exert. I can get along pretty good on level ground, just walking around, but I can't do any running or lifting, anything that requires physical exertion, because I get short of breath. As a result of being short of breath and those difficulties, is it necessary for you to keep any medical supplies or instruments around you at all times? Yes, I have a doctor's prescription for oxygen. I have to sleep with oxygen on at night and during the day. And he said when you need it to put it on. Yeah, it's kind of different. Different things affect the breathing, the humidity, the temperature. Any pollens in the air will make it a lot more difficult to breathe. And then I need the oxygen, medical oxygen, to make up the difference from the bad lung. Are you ever going to get over this, Mr. Albright? There hasn't been any change in the nerve or the diaphragm since the shooting, so the doctors say this will probably be a lifetime thing. How old are you, officer?
27.
You're 27 years old, and the doctors have told you that you will probably be this way for the rest of your life.
Yes, sir.
As a result of the bullet you received in the chest?
Yeah.
Does that mean for the rest of your life you're going to have an oxygen tank to breathe from?
Yeah.
What will that do to your law enforcement career, sir?
It'll put an end to it. There's a lot of physical activity involved in law enforcement, and I just can't do it anymore.
So there's no question in your mind now that if things remain the way they are, and it appears they're going to, you will not be a law enforcement officer anymore.
I don't see how I can.
Okay, just one last question, sir, and I should have chatted with you about it at that time. The individual depicted in, I believe it's States Exhibit number 7, that you identified as Mr. Hunter?
Yes, sir.
You have told me that his beard has been shaved and it's different today. Can you tell me how it is, sir? Can you make an identification of him as he sits here today with the change in the beard and the haircut?
Well, the eyes, the nose, the shape of the face, everything is the same. The only difference is the hair, but everything else, it just hasn't changed.
Do you think you'll ever forget that face that changed your life?
No, sir.
Do you ever wake up? Do you ever have dreams about it?
I've undergone a lot of counseling and that helps.
There's no doubt as to your identification.
No, sir.
I have no further questions at this time, Your Honor. Mr. Baird. Sir, you testified here the other day, did you not?
Yes, I did.
Sheriff Larry Jones from Rawlins County?
That is correct.
Okay, Mr. Jones, since this thing's been going on since February the 13th of 1985, have you had the occasion to be with James C. Hunter from time to time?
Yes, sir. He has been in my custody since.
And have you had the opportunity to watch him write his name, sign in or sign for things, etc., etc.? Part of the policy of my facility is that we check our people pretty regularly, and yes, I have. Can you tell this jury whether or not you've ever had the opportunity and or discuss with Rometta as it relates to using either his right or his left hand, ambidextrous?
Yes, I have.
Will you tell us what you've observed?
I've observed through an observation window Mr. Hunter writing letters, which he does mail a considerable amount, with both his right hand and his left hand.
Okay, has he ever commented with you that he can do it just as well with either one?
He had made a comment of such nature that he could write with either hand.
Now, you haven't seen him play softball and throw with his right hand and left hand, or hammer with a hammer. You're just telling us about his writing, right?
No, those are not available where he's at.
Thank you. No further questions. Mr. Lewis. Sheriff, how long did you say you've had him in your jail?
With the exception of a few days that he was here for the preliminary stuff, I believe it's 106 days as of today.
How large is his cell that he's been in most of the time?
Without going through a blueprint, I'm going to say it's probably somewhere in the vicinity of 155 square feet of floor area.
How long is it, Larry?
I'm going to say 12 feet long and probably 8 feet wide.
Okay, and he doesn't have a television back there?
No, he does not.
And there, it was a long time before he got himself a radio. But now he's got a radio, right?
I'm not saying a long time. I think he requested it the first week in there, and whatever time it took for his parents to forward him one.
Now, as a matter of fact, Sheriff, JC, or Jim, has told you that one of the things he's doing back there is teaching himself to write left-handed, hasn't he? I'm not sure he worded it that way, sir. There's been conversations that he is writing with his left hand. Now, whether he said he was teaching himself to do that or not, I don't know. Practicing? You've had some conversations with him about that, haven't you? I believe what he said was that he was refreshing himself in that capacity. Okay, when you signed your, when he signed into your jail, he signed in right-handed, didn't he? When he was brought into Rawlins County Jail, the KBI had asked me whether or not he had signed the fingerprint card right or left-handed. At that time, I could not advise them, but I felt it was right-handed. But because of that conversation, I did start observing when he was writing. Yes, sir. Have you observed what hand he uses most of the time to do most things with? I observed him eating. He eats with his right hand. As far as, you know, just sitting and watching him, I don't. Now, he's basically a right-handed individual, isn't he, Larry, from what you've seen of him? Most of the observations I make are during the nighttime hours. He sleeps a lot during the day. Uh-huh. And he is a night owl. He normally is up most of the night, so the observation is where there is nothing other than reading and writing. So you know how you read a book right-handed or left-handed? I don't know. Well, just use yourself. You've moved him in and out of your jail, back to the day room, back to his cell. You've had conversations with him. Yes, I've had a lot of conversations with him, yes, sir. I'm sure you know from talking to me all these years, I'm left-handed. Maybe you haven't noticed that. But basically, Mr. Hunter is a right-handed individual. Hasn't that been your observation? In certain things, right? Okay, that's all. Mr. Brooks, no questions, Your Honor. Mr. Baird, no questions. The court. You may step down. The court. Any other witnesses today? All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're through for the day. Be here at 9 in the morning. Remember my admonition to you? Don't discuss the case. You haven't heard it all. Don't try to let anybody else discuss it with you at this time. So we will recess now until 9 in the morning. Court is adjourned.
I'm Corey Zimmerman, and this is Spoon River Gothic, Season 2. Death Rides the Highway, a thrill ride fueled by murder in terror.
Death Rides the Highway.